We will call to order the March 24th meeting of the pensions, excuse me, that's what I'm thinking about, of the Commerce Committee. Our first order of business, the minutes from the last meeting. Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
Yep. All right.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis moves the minutes from the meeting of March 18th. Any questions, corrections on those? Hearing none, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Our first bill before us this afternoon is going to be House File 1647. And I will move that for the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hillstrom. If you'll go ahead and proceed, I know you have a DE amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair, and if you would just move the DE amendment.
I will move the DE-1 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would desire. Any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor of the DE-1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Hillstrom, your bill is in the order that you wish. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, House File 1647 is about medical debt. Medical debt is a serious and growing problem in America and in Minnesota, and thousands of Minnesota families are put in financial jeopardy based on their medical debt. Recent data from collections industry has indicated that 75 million Americans, that's 41% of adults ages 19 to 64, report having medical debt or having trouble paying their medical bills. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently found that medical debt has a distorted impact on people's credit scores. The Bureau found that because of the credit scoring model, the credit worthiness of consumers with medical debt was underestimated by 10 points and by 22 points for consumers who had paid that debt off. And according to a recent story in The Atlantic, which is in your packets, medical debt is the number one cause of personal bankruptcy and is responsible for more collections than credit cards. So the IRS has recently enacted rules for nonprofit hospitals that require them to tell patients their financial aid policy, if any is available, their charity care, and their hospital payment plans before taking out a medical lien, foreclosing on a patient's home, freezing their bank accounts, garnishing their patient's wages, suing the patient, or selling the debt to a debt buyer. The problem is that individual patients that are harmed by violations of these rules have absolutely no recourse under state or federal law. So this bill provides some modest recourse by allowing the patient to go to court and ask the judge to enjoin an extraordinary collection action. That term is defined by the IRS rule. If the patient shows that he or she was subject to one of those collection actions without ever getting the information required under those IRS rules about the financial aid policy of the hospital. So basically, if the hospital doesn't comply, they would be allowed to go to court to get that enjoined. So there'd be no monetary penalties assessed, no damages, no civil fines. However, if the patient proves a violation of the law, the patient would be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees. There's no public opposition that I'm aware of. And I want to acknowledge that we've been working with the Minnesota Hospitals Association and the Minnesota Associations of Collectors for we've been constructively working on this bill. And with me is Rick Varco from SEIU Healthcare to testify in support of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Varco, if you would identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Healthcare workers support House File 1647 because too many people, including healthcare workers themselves, can see families ruined by the epidemic of medical debt. Before unnecessary collections and illegal actions are taken, we ought to ensure that consumers know their options. One of our members, Monroe Von Ruden, who works at Alina St. Francis Hospital in Shakopee, was caught up in this issue. Her daughter was born with serious kidney issues and required 7 months of intensive hospital visits. Despite good health insurance, she quickly ran up over $5,000 in medical debt. Her employer, Alina, turned this debt over to a collection agency. The agency got a legal judgment, and Monroe's wages were garnished somewhere between $250 and $300 a pay period. After one of our staff alerted her to Alina's own charity care policy, Partners Care, Monroe applied and found out she qualified. To their credit, Alina did the right thing very quickly. They canceled her debt and refunded her lost wages. New IRS regulations for nonprofit hospitals will prevent situations like this. Under the new rules, Allina would have been required to give Monroe written information on their charity care policy before they started extraordinary debt collection actions. These regulations might have saved Monroe a lot of anguish and heartache. They might have saved Allina a lot of time, effort, and money. IRS rules, however, do not provide individuals with much of a remedy. The rules of a distant and blunt IRS do little to specific individual consumers who wind up in collections or courts. Senate File 1647 would allow, or House File 1647 would allow Monroe or someone in a situation like her to ask a judge to stop the collections until she got a copy of the charity care policy, and if she prevailed, to collect court costs. Just a couple of final points on this bill. Most Minnesota hospitals are run by really good people who want to do the right thing. We don't need this bill because of bad people working there. We need this bill because they are large institutions under extraordinary pressure to generate revenue and collect on the debts owed them. This bill is a small additional check on bad apples that will help prevent a race to the bottom. Two, this bill leaves hospitals in total control of their charity care policies. It doesn't require them to provide anyone with charity care, nor does it give anyone the power to reduce the amount of debt owed to them. Three, this bill doesn't require hospitals to do anything they're not already required to do under federal regulations. It just gives local Minnesota judges the chance to hold local hospitals accountable in specific cases without waiting for the distant and slow-moving federal government to respond. When large institutions are under tremendous pressure, it's usually the least powerful who gets squeezed the worst. This bill makes sure some of our most vulnerable debtors get a chance, at least, to see if they have another option. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Varco. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to reiterate, this says that they have to give the notice of the charity care and what's available before they can take the medical lien, they can foreclose on the home, freeze the bank account, garnish the wages, sue the patients, or sell the debt. This isn't about calling them on the phone. We just want to make it clear that this is about the extraordinary actions which would allow people to get into court.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the matter before the committee this afternoon? Seeing none and hearing none, members of the committee, questions for Representative Hillstrom on House File 1647 as amended. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, did you say extraordinary? Is it defined in IRS code, or is that in state statute somewhere, or federal law? What's
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, it is defined by IRS rules.
Thank you.
Other questions for Representative Hillstrom regarding 1647 as amended? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1647 as amended be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, members.
The next bill that we will be taking up is House File 1268, the Davids Bill. Representative Davids, welcome to the committee that you so aptly serve on. Give you the opportunity to move your bill, and I also notice that you have a DE1 amendment to the 1268.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 1268. And then, Mr. Chairman, I would move the H-1268 DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like.
And Representative Davids, that's going to the General Register.
Yes, sir.
All right. Any questions on the DE amendment? Hearing none, seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, Representative Davids, proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the bill is amended, it basically defines agent of record. And what we're looking at here is we have some situations where agents are not able to be paid a commission on the policies that they've written and that they have worked with. The bill also has some provisions for MNsure and how agents are to be paid on MNsure. Many agents that did sign up for MNsure have gone through the whole process, and then through some computer glitches or whatever happens, they're not listed as the agent of record, and it's really tough to get that situation correct. So they've spent 6 hours on one case, and you don't get paid much on these anyways. But we're just saying that an agent that's doing the work should get paid for his work, and I have someone that would like to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Davids. If you will go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, for allowing me to speak. My name is Chris Schneeman. I run an independent insurance agency here in St. Paul. I also serve as a legislative chairman for the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters and also for the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform. I am here to simply provide strong support and endorsement for the bill. We believe that in this time of change, Minnesotans need the most support that they can possibly get, both in the evaluation of what policy might be appropriate for them, as well as making sure they have appropriate assistance after the policy's been sold. This bill addresses barriers that exist for many policyholders who desire to have assistance from an agent by providing that the citizen has the right to select their personal agent, one that the insured has determined that they'd like to have their assistance from. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify in support of the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions on the House File 1268 as amended? Anyone from the public wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? Ms. Commit, welcome to the Commerce Committee. If you'll just go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I just want to state up front that we know how important and valuable agents and brokers are to helping consumers apply for health insurance coverage. The carriers rely on agents and brokers because they have the training and expertise to really assist consumers. We understand the intent of this bill is to correct one of the problems that resulted from MNsure, namely the difficulties agents and consumers experienced when they tried to sign up individuals for coverage through the exchange. We know there were agents who spent a great deal of time and effort to help consumers. This bill attempts to address those problems by allowing agents to retroactively appoint a navigator or insurance agent. We have a couple of concerns about how this would work from a practical standpoint and would like the opportunity to continue to refine the bill language so that it will actually work for the agents and brokers. In general, we would suggest that this would be allowed for agents and brokers who are certified by MNsure at the time of the purchase through MNsure, that the look back be changed from 18 months to 12 months, since some of the carriers only have 12-month contracts with agents and brokers, and that this be limited to those instances that were as a result of MNsure error. We've been in discussion with representatives from MAHU and will continue to work with them and with Representative Davids and members of the committee to find compromise language. So I just wanted to make sure we got on the record, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. Members, question for Ms. Commit. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if it's Ms. Commit or Representative Davids. Would this apply to agents selling health insurance outside of MNsure, or is this purely within the MNsure bounds? And
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Dean. This is not only for MNsure, this is agents selling in the exchange and outside the exchange.
Representative Dean. No follow-up. Any other member questions? Again, anyone from the public wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, I will renew my... Representative Davids, do you want to make final comments?
Yes, and to Ms. Commit's concerns there, this is a work in progress. I'll continue to work with the health plans. We have to make it work. If it doesn't work for them, it doesn't work for the agents, so we have to make this work. So I think we're very, very close on this, but I would renew my motion, House File 1268, as amended, be referred to the General Register.
Thank you for your willingness to continue to work on it, Representative Davids. Representative Davids renews his motion to re-refer House File 1268 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Davids. The next bill will be...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
The next bill before the committee is House File 1976. The chief author, Representative Albright. And as Representative Albright is making his way to the testifying table, I will go ahead and move House File 1976 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Representative Albright, welcome to the... I will clarify the motion that House File 1976 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and not the Jobs and Energy Commission.
Thank you, Mr.
Committee,
Chair.
Excuse me. With that, Representative Davids.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright, do you have an amendment that you'd like to have us consider at this time?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. I believe it's the A...
The A-15?
15.
Right. That is the amendment that I have in my packet. Members, Representative Albright would like to amend House File 1976 with the A-15 amendment to get it in the shape that he desires before the committee. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A-15 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Or Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1976 is the ever effervescent Department of Labor and Industry work comp bill. I have a gentleman.
Representative Albright, could you just move the mic up? We're not quite getting you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that better?
Thank you, yes.
1976 is the work comp bill for this session. It has been vetted by all the stakeholders pursuant to these activities. I have a testifier with me today that is willing to walk us through the provisions of the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Committee Chair, my name is Chris Liefeld. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Industry Workers' Compensation Division. I appreciate the opportunity to walk through the bill today. The bill is divided into three sections. Section 1 addresses the issue of electronic billing and payment transactions between providers and payers. Section 2 requires electronic funds transfer of monetary benefits to the employee or dependent by the employer insurer if requested by the employee. Section 3 amends reporting requirements when there is a hospitalization or fatality. In Section 1, Minnesota statute mandates electronic transactions for all payers and providers in Minnesota. This law does not specifically address the barriers unique to the workers' compensation system addressed by this bill. In paragraph C, the paragraph addresses the issue of healthcare providers having difficulty obtaining information that is needed to send the bill, the electronic bill, to payers or their clearinghouses. This paragraph requires workers' compensation payers to place on their websites in a prominent location or otherwise provide the information to healthcare providers, information that is needed to send an electronic bill to payers and any clearinghouse a payer uses to transmit the bill. Paragraph D establishes an electronic attachment standard for workers' compensation. The workers' compensation law requires that providers must send with the bill copies of medical records or reports that substantiate the nature of the charge and its relationship to the work injury. This requirement is unique to workers' compensation claims, and there is no nationally adopted standard for electronic submission of attachments. Providers and payers are given until July 1, 2016 to implement this attachment standard. In paragraph E, the issue addressed is providers having the need for matching payments to bills. Healthcare providers report receiving payments that cannot be matched to a specific bill. The proposed language in this paragraph would require information to be provided that is sufficient to allow providers to match payment to specific bills. Payers would be required to comply by September 1, 2015. Finally, in paragraph F, the legislation gives the commissioner enforcement authority with penalties. In section 2, this section requires that if it requested by the employee, the electronic funds transfer of monetary benefits to the employer dependent is required from the employer or insurer. This is required to be done within 30 days after the request if there has already been established an electronic funds transfer arrangement with a bank, savings association, or credit union for the employee's account. If there is no such relationship, it is expected that reasonable efforts are made to establish such an arrangement in 14 days, which is prior to the start of the 30-day deadline. The department also has enforcement authority with penalties for this section. Concerns brought by the self-insurers have been addressed and agreed to by labor and by labor for substituting credit union for a financial institution and moving the effective date to January 1, 2016, an amendment which you've already made. Finally, in Section 3, this section amends the time for which fatalities and hospitalizations must be reported to be consistent with new federal OSHA requirements. Minnesota OSHA has adopted the federal OSHA reporting rule as well. It requires a report of a fatality to Minnesota OSHA within 8 hours of a fatality and within 24 hours of a hospitalization. It allows Minnesota employers to make one phone call, or to continue to make one phone call to DLI to report fatalities and hospitalizations, so employers can comply with both Minnesota workers' compensation law and Minnesota OSHA laws at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Liefeld. Members, questions for Mr. Liefeld. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Liefeld, the records that you're going to be sending electronically now, they're sent in by virtue of this bill, are now being sent via paper trail. Is that correct?
Mr. Liefeld.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. That is a concern that the payers and providers have had, which is that too much of it is being done by paper. And so part of what our effort here is to get more of it done electronically, if at all possible. In 2009, legislation was passed that mandated the electronic transmission of a bill, the whole transaction process. And this is an effort to get more of those moving forward and taking place.
Thank you.
Other member questions for Mr. Liefeld? If not, our next testifier on the schedule is Mr. Gerber. And Mr. Gerber, did you want to come down and testify? And Mr. Leto, if you wanted to come down as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Gerber, welcome to the committee. If you go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I thank Representative Albright as well as all the members of the Advisory Council for bringing this bill forward. We think this is a good bill. I don't know if labor is here as well, but we've worked with them to address some of the issues, and we are supportive.
Any other testifiers or member questions? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 4, under 418, I'm looking at the commissioner may assess a monetary penalty of $500 against the employer or insurer for a violation of paragraph B or D. And I went back to B and D, and it sounds like if they were late in paying it or hadn't, you know, made a mistake or decided not to pay, they're going to be assessed a $500 fine. Is that correct?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to take it a step further, those penalties are paid into the commissioner, and actually the party that's wronged is probably the injured worker that didn't receive a check in a timely fashion. Would it be possible to alter some of this language to make certain that that $500 penalty went to the injured worker rather than a commissioner and his staff?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin, I can certainly take that back to the stakeholders and see if that's something that they can work out amongst themselves.
Thank you. Thank you.
Other member questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. My question as I begin to look at this is actually line 3.3, and it talks about the monetary penalty of $5,000 for each violation of the section or rule adopted under paragraph F, not to exceed $25,000 for identical violations during a calendar year. So as I read this, it's entirely possible that if a employer had, you know, let's say it's a large employer, you know, like say 1,500 people, and they did made mistakes or violated for, you know, 50 individuals at $500 a shot, that's $25,000. And if they had a different violation, would that then mean that they're exposed to $50,000? And if they had a third violation, would that mean they're exposed then to $75,000? I guess I'm not really understanding completely how these may escalate for a particular employer to the point that instead of paying $500 or $1,500, that they could be paying, you know, $75,000 or more.
I see that Mr. Liefeld has rejoined Representative Albright. Maybe he's the person who is best suited to answer this question. Have I guessed right on there, Mr. Liefeld?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright? Representative Dean, I think Mr. Liefeld probably can corroborate, but the issue as it is responded in line 3.3, the word is may, and as we heard yesterday, that's a permissive word. And to the extent that the enforcement action is for intent, as opposed to an innocent oversight on the part of the company, that's the determination of the enforcement action itself. So if it's a innocent oversight, I'm certainly that would be taken in consideration. But if there's been shown to be proven intention against a workforce individual, I think that's where the enforcement action would take place.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. I mean, I understand that to a point, but it says for identical violations during a calendar year. So, in other words, if, you know, there are several mistakes, you know, it can begin to escalate it, and maybe the argument or the consideration of the commissioner might be that if they're having several mistakes, maybe it's a larger issue than just a few mistakes. So I guess when I read that identical violations during a calendar year, I understand that if there are different types of violations, it's possible that it could escalate significantly. Is that correct?
Representative Albright.
Yes, we would concur with that.
Other member questions? Is there anyone from the department that would like to maybe weigh in on the previous question asked by Representative Dean? Seeing none, I think we've got our answer then. Other member questions? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 1976, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, members in committee.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming back.
Representative Slocum, if you want to come forward, we'll take your bill next, which is House File
1825. He's a good carpenter. Oh, thank you. Get the hair like four men.
What's that?
We like the hair of four men.
Oh, really? Cool.
Okay, one of these parted up. In a partridge family or something.
Is that a good
thing for the guys? Hmm? Yeah,
Representative Slocum, if you'd like to go ahead and move your bill, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1825.
You re-referred to public safety?
Public safety, indeed.
And you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to do that right away?
Yes, I would like to. The A1 amendment deletes subdivision 5 in the bill. And what it does is it eliminates the civil penalty to repay the state. And if you have any questions about that, I'm going to do my phone-a-friends.
Well, Representative Slocum, I think we'll go ahead and vote on that amendment and put it on to get it in the shape that you want it, and then we can you can tell us about the bill or go to your testifiers, whatever is your preference. With that, what was the A1? Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Slocum, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank you for hearing this bill. It's a pretty important one that I wasn't even aware of until recently that this kind of stuff goes on. House File 1825 makes illegal and imposes penalties for the design, development, sale, or possession of computer software that alters and creates fraudulent accounting records for businesses. The computer software called Zappers suppresses recorded sales so that a business appears to have fewer or lesser sales than they actually do. The result of this fraud is that the business appears to owe the state less sales tax money. Currently, Minnesota has no law against the sale of suppression Zapper software. This bill will help the Department of Revenue ensure that businesses are not cheating by not paying the appropriate sales tax. Just for your information, you may say, well, how prevalent is this? This has to be just a little problem. Oh, no. Oh, no. We aren't talking petty change here. The National Restaurant Association estimates a tax loss of $41.2 million from 9,767 restaurants and an estimated loss of $17.8 million from Minnesota convenience stores and restaurants, all because of the use of Zapper software. So we're losing a chunk of sales tax money that could go to a lot of different things. This takes money away from our law-abiding, hardworking businesses and Minnesotans. Please vote to stop this and support this bill. And I have two testifiers. I have Paul Cummins and Margaret Riesdorf from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. And as far as hearing your bill, it was our pleasure. Don't tell anyone else on the committee, but you're my favorite. With that, whoever you want to have go first is fine with me.
No.
Representative Davids, do you have a question right now, or do you want the testifiers to go?
Testifiers.
Okay. Mr. Cummings, Ms. Riesdorf?
No, you were my favorite.
Oh,
it's yeah.
We'll talk after committee. Whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to come before you to be a resource on this bill. This legislative proposal makes it unlawful for persons to sell, purchase, install, transfer, possess, access, or use tax evasion software designed to falsify sales tax records to avoid collecting and remitting sales tax. This tax evasion software is sold factory installed on point of sale machines or cash registers, sold separately, and it's even sold as a cloud-based service. So what is sales suppression device or software, sometimes called a zapper? It's a computer function that facilitates tax evasion. The sales suppression can be facilitated through flash drives, removable CDs, or access through the internet. It allows businesses to avoid remitting sales and income tax on deleted or reduced receipts. In these cases, businesses retain sales tax collected from their consumers. In other states, we found that businesses with customers that pay for more of their transactions in cash are the highest users of the software. In these situations, some businesses create two sets of books, while others remove the sales data from all of their records. So, Mr. Chair, on the slide, you can see an example of a hardwired zapper. There's actually a device that they hardwire into the system. Other times, the software can be placed, as I said, on a removable CD. It also is a service that you can actually do on the cloud. So you can send it up to the cloud, and then the cloud will remove transactions, and then you'll send it down as your point in which you are doing. And we'll give an example in a second. In a 2009 New York sting operation, 22 of 23 salespeople selling point-of-sale system cash register to a retailer offered the retailer sales suppression devices, software, or services without prompting. So I'm just going to give you a couple transactions as it went there. For the person who was acting as the purchaser, this is what they said. And you still delete our files for us even though you know it will be destroying original evidence. Well, you'll still delete us our files for knowing that this is evidence that tax authorities will be looking for. The salesman said, of course, something like that, because you know what people in a lot of restaurants ask me, I just need you to know this. It's not a problem for me. Salesmen continue to say, there's no law that says you have to keep the original point of sales system records. There's nothing in law that says that. Here's an example of when they were describing phantomware in which they might go up to the cloud. The potential purchaser said, the question is this. You say that if we make, like on a weekly basis, say $10,000 cash, we'd like to go to other numbers instead of 10,000. We'd like to go a little lower. Bring it down, the salesman said. The purchaser said, bring it down for bookkeeping and accounting to, let's say, $5,000, right? The salesman said, well, the purchaser went on to say, is there anything that you can give us, like, for the back office, where this will be in the front and that will be in the back? The salesman said, oh, no. The purchaser said, no. Well, the salesman said, well, I can manipulate it. Uh-huh. The salesman wanted to say, I can manipulate it. And then he showed how he could take the QuickBooks and move it up to the cloud and send it back down. So those are just a couple of examples. Representative Slocum talked about the potential impact that's currently happening in the state and the revenue loss due to Zappers. So if you go to the fourth page of your of the PowerPoint presentation, members, you'll see a receipt. And you'll see the there's an original receipt, reprint of the real receipt on the right-hand side, and then a reprint of the modified receipt. And then the real receipt is something that would come out for the consumer. You see the actual items that had been bought by the consumer. So if we were seeing all the receipts that came out of the register, these are the types of receipts that you'll see. But through the Zapper technology, the receipts will actually change. So when an auditor would come in and look at the receipts that would go on, they would actually see the transactions within receipts have changed. So instead of a lunch combo, you might see an iced coffee instead. As you can see on the right-hand side, the total is $45.80, and the tax paid on that is $4.35 for a total of a little over $50. But, Mr. Chair, you can see the Zapped receipt, the tax is $1.94. So the sales tax is a trust tax. It is collected with the expectation that the business will remit that to the state. And in this case, those taxes are not being remitted to the state. Those purchases are being zapped, and less sales tax is being collected. Ms. Reisdorf from our legal team will talk a little bit more about the history of this language and then what is going on in other states.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Ms. Reisdorf?
Chair of the committee, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Reisdorf, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Can you move to the map? Is the map the next one? Okay. So where did this all begin? Essentially, in 2011, the state of Georgia was the first of the United States to actually enact a provision similar to House File 1825. And that legislation became the topic of the National Conference on State Legislatures Legislative Summit for that year in Texas. And with the help of various scholars, in particular Richard Ainsworth, who is the director of graduate tax at Boston University, NCSL spent time at the summit talking about this problem and developing the language upon which House File 1825 is based. For instance, the transcripts that Paul was reading from were actually the New York sting operation. Actually, you can find, and I have a copy of the article if the committee would like it, in Dr. Ainsworth's special report for state tax notes that was published in August 4 of 2014. The state of New York actually provided the transcripts for that article. In any event, so in 2011 is where it began, and now where we sit, about 20 states have enacted similar legislation. And all of this legislation is really trying to get at the first step of this problem, which is to make sure that the sale, use, installation, development of this type of software is illegal and providing penalties. If the committee would like, I'd be glad to go through the language in detail, or I can talk a little bit more about some other state cases. Whatever you might prefer.
I think we're okay right now. I know Representative Davids had a question. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank Representative Slocum for carrying this bill and ask her if I could get on as a co-author. Is that okay? Members, just think about what we're talking about here for a second. I mean, if this doesn't make blood shoot out of your eyes, something's wrong. Because what they are doing here, I mean, it's just outright theft. And there, I hope it's a very small percentage of businesses that would enter into such a transaction, but this is costing the state a lot of money. And you know, my mother, God rest her soul, never told me life would be fair, but it just ain't fair. Mm-hmm. Because the ones that are doing it right are paying what they're supposed to be paying, mm-hmm. And these folks are getting out for half or 20% off or 30% off. So I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a great bill. It's something we need to put a stop to right away. And I want to thank Mr. Cummings for his work on this and going some of these issues with me in the past couple weeks here. So I hope every member can support this bill enthusiastically. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Other members, questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum. I noticed in the materials reference to the National Restaurant Association and $41.2 million from 9,767 restaurants in Minnesota. Is this sort of where this is happening for the most part, is restaurants? And I also had mention of convenience stores, and I'd like to place special attention to restaurants because we spent a lot of time last night talking about tipped employees, so thank you.
Representative Slocum or...
Mr. Chair and Representative, essentially, I think the province of Quebec provided a lot of the hard data that the states are using, in addition to work that states are collecting on their own. Back in 2002, the province of Quebec, which has a different tax system than we have, they are able to track inputs as well as outputs into businesses a little bit more readily. But in 2002, they estimated that restaurants in particular, because they tend to be cash-intensive businesses, that they estimated over 50% of all restaurants in the province were suppressing sales. And so that led that province to enact legislation similar to House File 1825, as well as require restaurants, as they applied for licenses to do business, to install encryption modules on all of their point-of-sale machines. And in 2011-2012, that calendar year, the province of Quebec saw an increase of revenue in the restaurant sector alone of over $160 million. And so that state stands as an example. We have a couple of cases here in the United States, one in Connecticut where a grocery store was under IRS audit and an income tax a deposit offshore account was found, and what was funding that offshore account they found was sales suppression. Similarly, there's a case in Michigan, the Le Chiche chain of restaurants. There are 13 restaurants. Again, I think it was over $4.2 million. And then in Ohio, the International House of Pancakes. So it's restaurants, but it's really any cash-intensive business, because what happens with the software suppression is that the transaction, cash transactions are a little bit easier to manipulate because you don't have any third-party data to contradict the transaction report after it's been falsified. You don't have a debit card or a credit card receipt, you know, from your card provider.
Thank you, Ms. Restore. Representative Dean, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up. So would we have to get to the point like we do with gas stations, that we have people go out and check the machines and see if they're actually dispensing the amount of gas that they say they are? I mean, would we have inspectors that are going out to cash registers in stores and restaurants to verify that that the software or the hardware that's in place in their, I guess it would be sales, point of sales machine, is actually not having these? I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand, if we pass this law, it's great, we've created these crimes, but at the same time, so how do we find out about it?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean and members, one of the things that we did is we were at an Association of Tax Administrators conference, which I know everyone's very thrilled about. But this was one of the discussion points that happened is, so do you move forward with some efforts in order to try and go after this behavior, to try and audit this behavior, or is this something that you should first try and make sure that there's some civil or criminal penalties related to this? The consensus from the groups that had done this, from the states that had done this, is they said it's really important that you have some penalties in place to go after this type of behavior before that's done. Now, Quebec is an example in which might be an outlier. They actually required that, I think, each cash register had this, and there was a large multi-million dollar outlay that went from the province of Quebec to many businesses in order to make sure that each transaction that came out from a cash register has done that. And that's obviously not something that the Department of Revenue would be working towards. But there are ways in which we can try and see if the receipts that are coming out and giving consumers are the same as what they're giving to the state. There's other ways in which we can try and look at that.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The attorney for the department mentioned something about offshore bank accounts. I just want to make sure this bill doesn't affect offshore bank accounts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, no, it does not affect offshore bank accounts.
Okay, so I won't have to recuse myself.
Representative Slocum, I think you finally found a subject that Representative Davids likes as much or dislikes as much as your opinion might be as continuing education. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this might be more for the Public Safety Committee, but just a devil's advocate, I support it. I think it's a good piece of legislation. I'm assuming that there's already a crime that makes it deliberate fraud in Minnesota a crime. So this gets at, from a enforcement standpoint, this is probably a more straightaway kind of fashion than to have to go through all of the records. But my question is actually in Subdivision 3 versus Subdivision 2. In sub 2, you've got it as a felony for intentionally and knowingly selling, purchasing, and so forth. Subdivision 3, it's a gross misdemeanor for a person who sells, purchases, installs, possesses, or accesses any of these devices. My question there is that there's no intent or knowing requirement, and I'm picturing a server or a restaurant owner, perhaps somebody who's acquired a restaurant. You come into possession of these devices without even knowing it, or a server accidentally uses one. By the way it's currently drafted, that's a little loose. Such that if you get a overzealous prosecutor, they could charge it out in that fashion. Thoughts with respect to that?
Ms. Restore.
Chair and Representative, that's a great question. I wanted to mention that anecdotally what we've learned from other states about this legislation as it's and similar statutes that have been enacted in the 20 states is that the primary purpose is not only to get at retailer behavior but also but absolutely at the folks that are selling this. So in that case, when you mentioned the fraud penalty initially, certainly a retailer using it, we would have the ability under our tax code to charge them both civilly and criminally, but those wouldn't exist. Without this legislation, that would not exist for the seller or developer of the automated suppression software, as well as any employees or agents of the retailer that might be using it on a like on a removable disk. We've seen cases where it's not the retailer at all; it's in fact an employee who is zapping sales and pulling the money out. So that's why it's drafted with the penalties that it does. Now, to your question with regard to subdivisions 2 and 3, you're exactly right. With those two taken together, the intent there is to create a strict liability scheme so that not only intentional and knowing behavior is criminalized, but also we want to hold folks vigilant to be on the lookout for this. So, for instance, if there's an employee who knows that it's being used, that they recognize there may be a penalty that would apply. So that's the idea. That's the idea there.
And Mr. Chairman, and I don't mean to turn this into the public safety or some other committee, but I get your point. I just think you're wrong. And I think if you get to the floor and it's still drafted in this fashion, you're going to see it should go up all green for the very reasons that Representative Davids and Slocum have pointed out. But if you get there and you've got the kind of thing that's going to trap a server or a restaurant owner that acquires a restaurant and doesn't even know that they've got these devices and there was no intent, we don't make crimes out of things. Generally, we don't make crimes where there isn't some intent or knowing or at least reckless behavior. And that's what's going to trip up the bill if it continues to move in the fashion that it's currently drafted. We saw that last night with a little bit of loose language where the bill was pulled back into another committee, and I don't want to have that happen with respect to this one. So that's just me talking. I know you may want to visit with other members as well, but otherwise I think it's a terrific bill, and I support it, and I look forward to getting $160 million in new revenue.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. The $5,000 fine or $3,000 fine, that seems kind of light to me. I'm just wondering, nationwide, you have 28 other states or thereabouts that have the similar law in place. After they're caught in those other states or in Minnesota, is the IRS going to come in and really clean house on them?
Ms. Riesdorf?
Chair, Representative, the provision, the subdivision 5 that was removed did provide penalties that would allow the disgorgement of all profit. So that's in the original draft, that would have been added to the civil penalty. But certainly, you know, I don't know what the IRS's policy for audit is, but I would hope that, you know, that there would be some sort of coordination of effort there.
You know. Representative Sundin, follow-up? Good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for a $5,000 fine or a $3,000 fine, I'd take the risk on buying a zapper. But if the IRS was behind you on this, I'd think twice.
Members, other questions? Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Representative Slocum will give you the final word.
Slocum's got an inside track.
I think that this is a good bill. We're getting cheated. The state is. You, me, us. Well, Representative Sundin would put a zapper in. Most of us wouldn't. And I'd like to see this passed into law. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. With that, Representative Slocum renews her motion that House File 1825, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Sundin.
177.
Excuse me?
Chair Hoppe, that would be
thank you.
Representative Slocum. Chair Hoppe.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say Sundin? Oh, I'm sorry.
You thought she was your favorite.
Well, I told Sundin he was my favorite earlier. I'm trying to cover all my bases.
Thank you,
Representative Slocum, and your testifiers. Representative Sanders. And members, while we're at it, I should have thought of this earlier. But any of your papers that you can take out of the green folders and make piles of them, it helps the pages and others clean up more quickly afterwards. So if you're just sitting there thinking about Representative Sanders' deep words of wisdom, might be something to occupy us while we're moving here. With that, Representative Sanders, go ahead and move House File 177, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 177 to be referred to the General Register. And that is because I have a DE3 amendment that I would like to move as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that I wish.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. I was just going to ask you that. So Representative Sanders would like to move the DE3 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign.
Yeah.
Motion barely prevails, but it prevails. With that, Representative Sanders, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 177 is an important bill that permits self-storage agents to sell insurance for personal property stored at that facility. The bill specifies that self-storage agents are only allowed to sell insurance relating to personal property stored at facility for incidents occurring at that facility. And with me today is Mr. Dietz, who would like to offer some testimony on the bill as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Mr. Dietz, welcome to the committee. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My name is Tim Dietz, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your committee today. I represent the National Self-Storage Association and the Minnesota Self-Storage Association, which we have a great relationship with. With approximately 860 self-storage facilities in the state, House File 177 represents an issue of importance to small business self-storage operators in your state. 85% of self-storage operators are small businesses, so this is really small business legislation. As Representative Sanders outlined a little bit, the aim of this bill is to allow self-storage facilities to offer consumers an affordable insurance option if they do not hold a homeowner's or renter's insurance policy covering the contents of a storage unit. Typically, more than half of our customers are in transition, which creates a gap in coverage. Also, with little to no deductible, is also attractive often to those who have a homeowner's or renter's policy. Offering coverage to protect tenants' personal property can also provide critical protection for self-storage operators in general. We rent space. There is no care, custody, or control with our lease agreements, and the facility operators are not responsible for the tenant's possessions. But there have been instances where facility operators have been ordered to pay for damages to customers' contents. Had there been a tenant insurance program in place, coverage would have been relatively simple. This has led the industry to recognize the growing importance of providing access to tenant insurance. Not only have 20 other states already authorized this type of limited self-storage insert in recent years, which represents 65 of facilities throughout the country, incidentally, but this approach follows a common solution that has been successfully implemented for industries well known to Minnesotans, as I understand it, including travel, rental cars, and mobile electronics. Finally, we don't see regular insurance agents, and I know many of the representatives here may be insurance agents, and we don't see regular agents and property and casualty and so forth who want to offer insurance coverage for 3 or 4 months at $8 premiums for $2,000 of coverage. So again, this all plays to the gap we're talking about here. So simply, enabling self-storage facilities to provide their customers needed protections will expand access to insurance for a significant number of tenants that do not have a current homeowner's or renter's policy. I'll be glad to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sanders.
I would just like to say to you, the DE3 amendment is language that we've worked with the insurance folks and the self-storage folks and gets us to a place where we could get both those industries to sign off on the language. So we believe that the DE3 amendment is language that this committee could fully support.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Davids, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. And maybe to staff here, research. Just reading through this, are there any loss ratios that have to be at any certain levels? A lot of times when these policies are written, it has to be at least a 65% loss ratio.
Chair, Representative Davids, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, so to the testifier, in other states, what kind of loss ratios are these companies having?
Thank you for the question. So I'm not an expert in the insurance industry. I represent, of course, the self-storage sector, but I can certainly get back to you with that answer.
Okay.
But it varies, I'm sure, state to state.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Davids,
just to verify to the testifier, I don't see any continuing education in here. Would they have to have continuing education to maintain their license?
Mr. Dietz, just say no.
No.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
To the testifier, two quick things here. One is, how many companies are domiciled or foreign companies in Minnesota that would come in and write this? I mean, is in these other states, like who's writing this? Like Allstate, State Farm, Shifting Sands Mutual. I mean, who's writing this stuff?
Mr. Davids.
So there are 8 or 9 companies that specialize in self-storage rental insurance. And there's a company called Bader Company, Minico Insurance, so forth. I can provide you with a full list, but they're all admitted insurance companies. They would all,
Mr. Chairman, they're not surplus lines. They'd be actually.
No, they would not be surplus lines. I believe we addressed that in the legislation. The surplus lines that would not be included.
Okay, and then Mr. Chairman, and to the author, maybe, where does the Commerce Department fit in here? Have they signed off on this? Or are they? I don't see where if there's a problem. who the person goes to.
Mr. Dietzen, Representative Sanders and Representative Davids, we have Mr. Brickwood. He looks like coming down to answer that. Mr. Brickwoody, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Peter Brickwoody from the Commerce Department, Representative Davids. A couple of points. There is an exemption from licensure, hence no continuing education credit for anyone selling this product. So we address that for you preemptively. The Commerce Department would have regulatory authority over the products that have to be filed. So if there was some sort of dispute, there would be a recourse for the consumer. We have talked with the advocates in the drafting of the DE3 amendment, which the department didn't see until this afternoon. We missed a couple of things that are in place in the rental car section, which we're trying to mimic here. So I think we're going to be working with Representative Sanders to try to pick those things up, which outline the process by which the department could take action in the situation that you are talking about here, where if there was some sort of dispute, what the process would look like. So that was, I think, unintentional. So it was just in the course of drafting the amendment. We missed that. So we're going to work together to get that put back in.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And since there is no continuing it, I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Just kind of my question was in general. I brought it up when I first was heard about this bill, but kind of the storage wars exemption to say, you know, if you have a client that essentially doesn't pay their bill but does have insurance from a law standpoint, you know, if you're going to lose the contents of your unit that you're renting, but you have insurance on it, how does that play out? And you know, from a
Representative Sanders, I was waiting for the storage wars question. I assumed it was coming from somebody.
I would my answer would be, Mr. Chair, that I'm assuming if you can't keep up on your storage locker, you're probably not going to keep up on your insurance premiums on that locker as well, but. That would just be my guess. I'll let Mr. Dietz answer.
Mr. Dietz?
You are correct, Representative. And just so you know, that show is not representative of our sector. It's kind of a nuisance to us. And just so you know, less than 1% of tenants end up in that situation. So it's very rare. But if they're not making their rental payment, it's likely, since the rental payment is along with the insurance payment, that you know they're in breach of that policy as well.
Mr. Dietz, I would assume of the people of that 1%, I would assume something like 1% of that 1% actually have treasure in their storage.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we don't see gold bars very often.
I wouldn't expect so. Representative Swidzinski, do you have a follow-up?
That's it.
Representative Lunin, and then Dean after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The typical market in the mini storage or temporary storage, like you said, is a mobile or in between situations, and a lot of them are young. I'm an insurance agent. I'm aware of several situations where young people have purchased furniture and they finance it at the store, and we're required to demonstrate to the lender of the store that they have that because the furniture is the collateral on the loan. And maybe you're not the one to answer this. Maybe the Commerce Department is, that these insurance agents or these people that are selling this insurance, they'll be providing the certificates of insurance or the binders to the lost payees in these cases?
Mr. Dietz.
I'm not sure about the specific answer about where the certificate would go to in these cases. But I do know when there is a note on items that are stored in the facilities that it has to be a code search to make sure that there's not, you know, another owner of the property that's going through a lien process.
Okay.
So, again, a rare circumstance.
But. Representative Luna.
And then just one quick final question is that this will have physical damage coverage on it, I'm assuming, and since it's regulated to the Commerce Department, the perils will be determined, the territory where the policy covers will be determined on location within 100 feet, however they do that. There's also a liability exposure when you have someone on your premises and for damage to your property or causing injury to someone who's helping them because of some negligent act. Do these products have a liability component to them as well?
They do not. They are exclusively for the contents of the storage unit. And liability, as I understand it, would be managed by the property insurance and so forth that's already on the property.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lunin. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Any final member questions? Representative Dean, I'm sorry, I forgot.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sanders, and to the testifier. So I don't sell insurance. I don't know how this works. I'm sitting here thinking. So I get a storage facility, and I'm in transition, and I don't have homeowner's insurance or other types of insurance that may cover me. And I think the value of the property that I'm going to be putting in there is $20,000. Do I purchase a policy for $20,000? Or do I purchase a general policy which has a range, and in the event that something happens, I have to show ownership of receipts or other types of things in order to prove that that was the value of my property? If you could just answer that, sure. That would be great.
Thank you for the question, Representative. So, first of all, self-storage facility lease agreements typically have a value limitation of, and 99% of them are $5,000 as specified by the business. And if you're going to extend your lease beyond that $5,000, then you're going to have a discussion with the operator of the facility. And he'd probably, he or she would probably tell you to go talk to a general agent. 99% of these tenant insurance policies cover $2,000, and then that's about where they are. So,
thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Dees, just a quick question on the policy. And I suspect it depends upon the marketability of the policy, but I think what happens is you might have an indemnity policy, and I don't want to have Representative Dean get confused on that with the idea that if you have a $2,000 limit, that's exactly what you're going to get a check written for. You may still have to show actual loss because it's not an indemnity policy.
Certainly there is a claims process that we would have to demonstrate that the loss. And that's, you know, that relationship is between the tenant and the insurance company. So the operator just offers the insurance, but it's the insurance companies that maintain that relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Dietz. Representative Sanders, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good bill. Urge members to support it. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 177 be referred to the General Register as amended.
Thank you. Those in favor of the adoption of the Sanders motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same side. Motion prevails. Thank you, members and Representative Sanders. He gets me on that every time.
Can we do minimum wage now?
That's good.
Our final bill on the agenda today is House File 1979, brought to us by our own chair, Representative Hoppe. Welcome to your committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 1979. What we're doing here is setting up an auto insurance reform task force, and I do have an A1 amendment to the
Representative Hoppe, to government operations, did I hear you say?
I didn't say, but that's a good, I think it does go to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good catch.
Proceed with your A1 amendment. I think there might be some corrections to the A1, some oral clarifications.
I have an oral amendment to the A1. After page 1, line 21, we are going to add the words, delete page 2, line 6. So if you turn the... I better check with staff to make sure we're doing this right, and that the amendment is to the oral amendment is to the amendment and not to the bill before we amendment, just to make sure we do this correctly.
That is accurate. At this point, you can make an amendment to the first amendment to the A1.
Okay. So all we're doing is on page 2, line 2.6, we're deleting that line. We're getting rid of the words no-fault health provider oversight. And I believe that is a compromise between some of the folks that are working on this issue.
Members, questions on the oral amendment offered by the bill's author, Representative Hoppe? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The oral amendment brings the A1 amendment into the form that the author would like. The A1 amendment, any questions on that? Well, I'm going to bet no, but we'll see what happens, Representative Davids. Anyone against?
Aye.
Oh, well, there's always one in a crowd, apparently, Representative Davids. Now, that brings us to the A1 amendment, as amended. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your support on the amendment. Again, there's been a lot of work done on this between the various parties involved and trying to get the... task force set up.
Any questions on the A1 as amended? If not, Representative Hoppe moves the A1 to be added to his House File of 1979 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
I'm good.
Still waiting. Representative Kreisha? Okay, you're good. All right, well, to your bill as amended, Representative
Hoppe. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That's the bill. It's fairly straightforward. We're just setting up a task force to deal with the problem of the issue of no-fault auto insurance, and I have a suspicion that there are some people that would like to come down and speak to the bill.
I see at least one person coming forward, former Representative Jim Abler. Mr. Abler, welcome to the committee. Field. State your name for the record.
Thanks,
proceed with your
Chair.
Testimony.
Jim Abler, Representative Suma MRI, and also in my own right. Nice to always come at the end of the meeting where there's like 30 seconds left, and that's about enough here for me anyway, probably. But I'm here to support the compromise and the work Representative Hoppe has on making this piece of this task force be productive. But I also wanted to encourage the members in another short time. We had a short time in the last time I was here talking about no-fault task forces. Most of these fail. Because the people on all sides of the discussion are afraid to engage in a meaningful way for fear that some harm will happen to them. And so I hope that the members who are chosen from the House and the Senate and the people who are represented have the courage to truly address the three topics that are remaining that are very important in the no-fault world. Not just for those people who are in the business of it, like myself and lawyers and insurance companies, but those who benefit by the ongoing status of no fault in our state. Having no fault is a very good thing. And the chance to get proper coverage for your losses, both physical and in a private property damage, is very important. And we're lucky to have it. And so I hope this group is successful. Otherwise, and so yet we'll continue litigation that goes on. My client just had a ruling in his favor where an attorney got the checks and signed his own name and didn't give him, they were co-written, and the attorney kept the money without giving them to the provider. The insurance company was unwilling to take responsibility. They had to sue, which increases costs, and they were found that the liens were actually valid, and so the company had to pay. And the people who kept the money got to keep the money, which is just an amazing world. And so all that gets, in all this, you lose the client and the person who was injured, and that's the point of this. So I just wanted to come and I wish Chair Hoppe success in his summer's work, and a lot of us will be there watching and cheering. So members, please vote for the bill, and please cheer the champion of good government on in his work. Thank you.
Wait, summer?
Thank you, Mr. Abler. Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee at this point? House File 1979 as amended. Member questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Hoppe. So is there a consumer on the task force, or is it pretty much just industry and, you know, folks within the administration and the legislature?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. You can, look at it, and the people that are on there are on there. There's nobody that, we didn't designate. I guess there's not anyone who said, an average automobile insurance consumer. I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I don't know how you'd pick that person.
Representative Dean, follow up?
No, I just, it would seem that somehow we need to have some type of voice from the consumers in this process. And I don't know if that means that at some point the task force have to hold a public meeting about what they're doing, what their findings are, or just a way so that there is some public input.
Representative Dean and members, these will be public meetings, and they'll be noticed and open to the public, and people can certainly come and testify. I've participated in other task forces like this, most recently the auto insurance, not having enough auto insurance, whose name I can never remember. And people from the public are more than welcome to come and testify. And I'll start with the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, Association for Justice, Ambulance Association, Medical Group Management Association of Minnesota. All of these groups represent various constituencies, but at the end of the day, they're all there to represent their groups and the consumers. We all, I think, are doing this to try to make something that works for providers, for insurance companies, and ultimately for the consumers you know, the people that are going to, in the long run, benefit from the no-fault system.
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, that was my question.
Outstanding.
I don't have anything else.
Outstanding. Any other questions for the bill's author? If not, Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 1979, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. That concludes our bills for the day. I'll give the last word today on the committee to Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate your support. We'll see you tomorrow.
With that, we are adjourned.